Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Wall Street Wildlife Podcast. We've got three big questions we're tackling today. Christoph, you made an NVIDIA trade. We're going to answer the question, is AI a sustainable investing trend?
We're also going to talk about an essential process to improve your investing gains, because my buddy, the Badger, is doing some ongoing live portfolio reviewing, and it's really, really key to his gains and his process. So check it out.
And our last big question for today's episode is, what's the latest tool in the hacker's arsenal, and why does this make cybersecurity the most durable and important investing trend of this decade? I'm Luke the Badger Hallard. My buddy is Christoph Monkey Pikarski, and this is the Wall Street Wildlife Podcast.
All right, Badger. So first up, to conclude our NVIDIA discussion from last week, or is it 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago, maybe. Now, we made a bet based on NVIDIA's earnings, and I confess that I bought one share of NVIDIA pre-earnings.
You took the whiskey money essentially, and you've rolled it into NVIDIA shares. By the way, that's not to say I'm about to spend $674 on whiskey for you when we meet up in Austin in a few weeks' time.
Oh, we shall see. It depends on the kind of whiskey we're drinking. So I bought the share pre-earnings at $674, holding my nose, because anyone following this story knows that NVIDIA's stock price has been absolutely atmospheric. So at the start of the year, NVIDIA was around 490. It is now 870.
And it nearly pipped up above $1,000. So it's come back down to 870. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it was close. Yeah, it was close to 1,000. So point being is that I bought a share at 674. And I sold it, I think on Friday, or at 9:55 for a 42% gain in an already gigantic mega cap. Gigantic, I think it's the fourth largest asset in the world now at $2 trillion something. So to gain 42% in value of an already gigantic asset made me really, really doubt the extent to which this is sustainable. And so, in order, I mean, so I sold. That's what I did. I'm voting with my dollars. I'm saying that it's just gotten completely out ahead of itself.
So today you own no NVIDIA today.
Correct. So I no longer have any NVIDIA, but I think you rightly said in our discussion before we started recording, that kind of short-termism is not what long-term investors do. And, you know, going just hopping in and hopping out. But, what, you know, I'm thinking to myself, what can I do that has some value? And I decided to really look, try to better understand AI as a general concept. Because the more secure I could be in my knowledge and understanding of what this thing is, the less likely I'll be to hold into something that's just a fad, or selling will be appropriate if it is, in fact, you know, problematic on whatever foundational levels. Yesterday was the Oscars, and the best picture, Oppenheimer, won pretty much everything. To me, that's a story that's analogous to what's happening with AI. You have discrete groups of people who are devoting their lives, some of the smartest people in the world, to building something that was never built before. And I think the question for many people at this moment is, you know, what are the foundations of this thing? What are the costs? What are the dangers? Is this real? And so in shout out to this book, The Maniac, by Benjamin Labatou. For those of you who have not heard of it, it's a story of essentially the birth, the seeds of AI, starting with the biopic of Johnny von Neumann, who is considered the smartest person of the 20th century. And he, in part, invented computers and game theory and worked on the atomic bomb at Los Alamos. But the second half of the book takes those beginnings, his beginning theories of an emergent intelligence, and fast forwards us to the time of AlphaGo defeating the world's best Go player, which is, you know, a shocking event for humanity because it seemed like a new kind of intelligence was born.
And actually, interestingly, I think that was almost 8 years ago today when Lee Sedol got beaten by AlphaGo, and the world has moved on significantly even since then.
Yeah, so the next thing I did, Badger, is I think you did too. You listened to a conversation on the Lex Fridman podcast with the chief AI scientist over at Meta. And
Jan LeCun talking about his views on AI and like perhaps the limitations of large language models. Very interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I'm not sure what I'm left with. I'm not sure what conclusions I'm left with other than it seems to me that on one hand, there's a form of AI that you could see in Go that I think currently NVIDIA and all other graphics cards are enabling that has immense power to, for example, win at Go, immense beyond what we thought, but it does not seem to me that that is translating or will translate anytime soon to the kind of general AI, AGI, that might disrupt all kinds of industries.
I would argue it doesn't need to, right? Mm-hmm. So like LLMs, if you're playing with things like Gemini and ChatGPT and Perplexity AI and Claude and all these different systems, like they have incredible value to me right now and to lots of industries. And maybe later this episode, we'll talk about a little bit about how even hackers are using these tools to make their lives easier. For good or bad, they're making all companies more efficient. Good example, private Swedish buy now, pay later company Klarna had a press release just a couple of weeks ago, I think, where they said they were using an OpenAI powered chatbot to do the work of 700 call center agents. So you got like, there's a little bit of skepticism around that claim, but certainly you've got like a real company generating real dollar value, operational efficiency, because they're using these tools, not necessarily to displace people, but to make people operate, make their humans operate at a higher level. And so that's just great for all companies. And, you know, if like the companies using the tools are saving money or making more money, well, that's going to translate into more money for the companies like NVIDIA creating the capabilities for these tools.
That all sounds legit and correct. I think the worry I'm left with is around commodification. It does seem like some of the foundations are that learning language models are already really, really, really good. They're going to get better, but now we're playing with a limited data set, and the market is forward-looking. And so when I see a spike in NVIDIA's price that is already magnitudes, orders of magnitude to get from 223 to almost 1,000, that's a 5x.
Well, let's put it in real numbers because like the share price is just like a made up number. Like this is a $2 trillion company. Can it become a $3 trillion, a $10 trillion company? You know, at some point we run into the limits of like our ability to monetize this stuff.
Right. There's a limit to how many chips I think foundationally need to be employed. And this kind of stock price, meaning the $2 trillion market cap, I think suggests to me that the market thinks these kinds of sales will continue in perpetuity. Whereas what I'm really trying to parse out is to what extent is this analogous to what happened with the birth of the internet? And I think my conclusion, sorry this is messy, because it's an unknown, where, you know, like the atomic bomb building in the 50s, this is new terrain for humanity. And the reason I sold my shares of NVIDIA is I think the market has gotten way, way ahead of itself, predicting that this kind of growth will go on for a very, very long time. I don't see it.
I think it could. Like, whether it's NVIDIA or whether it's other companies in the same ecosystem, like Taiwan Semiconductor, like ASML, like some of the other companies, like the hyperscalers, like Google and Amazon, building their own hardware as well. I think this is like a relentless growth from here, because we're only literally only just taking our first steps in realizing like actual operation, like actual true efficiencies from these tools. Mm-hmm. Like here, that, you know, that Klarna example I just gave, that's one of the first press releases we've actually seen where a company's claiming we've made a saving, like we've saved 700 headcount in our organization. And I think that's like the beginning of a wave where we're going to see many, many stories like that as companies start to implement these tools.
If you'll allow me a little bit of the philosophizing just for 30 seconds, it's a worrisome time, I think, from the perspective of what the best picture Oppenheimer revealed to us, that when we're playing with an incredibly new and powerful technology, there's a non-zero chance that the world might blow up. To me, that was the most terrifying thing about that film, and maybe why it won Best Picture. And yet, humans do it anyway. In other words, that's part of the lesson of the maniac in this film. Like, we are the kinds of creatures who can't help themselves. If it's there for us to monkey with, we're going to monkey with it, even if it might blow up the world. What gives me pause about, I guess, NVIDIA's rise, the meteoric rise, is that it seems like the price and the value of these companies are being, they're suggesting to me that we don't care. We're not going slow enough. We're not taking the proper measures, and it's going so fast, so quickly, that we're going to disrupt maybe perhaps one too many things before we could control them. I'm uneasy. That's obviously a very different question from investing itself, but many investors care about ethics. You know, like, some investors would not invest in cigarettes for ethical reason. I'm not saying NVIDIA is unethical. Don't confuse me. But I am saying that if you took a little bit of a mental, you know, trip, if you imaginary exercise, would you invest in the atomic bomb players back in the 50s if that was easily available?
Well, I mean, I am now investing in companies like Lockheed Martin, because war seems inevitable and those companies seem like they're necessary, a necessary evil perhaps, but this is the state of the world.
Well, I think there are plenty of investors who weigh ethics seriously. I'm not making a value judgment in one shape or another. I think I'm encouraging people to dive deep into these topics so that if you buy something like NVIDIA, you have a better understanding of the trajectory of the story, where we have been, where we are, and where it's going. And in this moment, it's such a preposterously fast rate of change that's happening that it's bewildering. And I think some people just stop at the share price and forget what's, you know, driving this underneath.
I mean, to me, this is like the next, well, this is happening right now, but it's the next industrial revolution, right? And, you know, we've invented iron or steam or something, and we're just figuring out now how this thing is going to change society. That feels like a sustainable investing trend for me.
I'd say it's probably more disruptive than the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Well, it's that on steroids, because stuff happens so much faster with each iteration. Oh. Yeah.
Right. Okay. You are doing something phenomenal for yourself and for anyone following you on Instagram. You're being a conscientious investor, examining your own portfolio, starting from what you call the bottom, working your way to the top. Can you tell us about the motivation behind this process? Can you describe it for us, and what got you to do this?
So I think there's a takeaway here for anybody who's a long-term investor or has been investing for a couple of years at least, and you've got something to look back at. Because to me, like, I love that aphorism, if you can measure it, you can improve it. And like, that's kind of a almost like a guiding statement I apply to my entire life. Like, I live my life in spreadsheets. I measure everything. Literally everything. Like, I hit my new personal best top speed ever on skis a couple of weeks ago, and I hadn't been measuring everything. I wouldn't know what that was.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. 76 miles an hour.
106?
76 miles an hour, yeah.
Wait, 176?
No, 76, not 176. That would be world record long.
Right,
76,
no.
76 is quick enough. 76 is quick enough for me, trust me.
Yeah, holy.
It's still pretty damn fast. measure everything. And so I have got 20 years plus now of records of every trade I ever did, every buy, sell, trim, add. And for that last 20 years as well, I've been fairly diligent in at least noting down a couple of sentences as to why I did that trade, what I was thinking at the time. So I realized maybe 5 or 6 years ago, well, actually, here's something I've been measuring and I haven't done the analysis on it. So I started, generally every couple of years. I think this is probably the third or fourth time I've done this process, but it becomes more diligent each time. I've gone back and looked through my entire trade history, and I've looked at like the stuff I sold and what did the stock do afterwards, and the stuff I bought and how did it perform. And I'm just trying to draw lessons out of that. And I'm basically analyzing my own behaviors and trying to figure out how can I improve. And so in the last 2 years, last year and this year, I've realized actually it might be quite fun to do this in public. And I was doing it on just Twitter. And this time I'm having extra fun because I'm doing it on Twitter and Instagram and Threads and TikTok and all the rest of them. So what I'm doing is every day, as you say, from my smallest position, which is, I think, New Scale Power, the small modular reactor guys, up to my very biggest position, which I think I've probably been public in saying is Intuitive Surgical, the medical robots doing surgery. I'm going through every stock I own, and once a day, I'm sharing when did I buy, sell, add, you know, how did I actually trade that over the years? And I'm trying to draw some insights out. So I'll tell you a little bit about each of these companies that I currently own. I'm going to do a 50-day challenge. So on day 50, I'm going to share my entire portfolio. So if you're interested in seeing, like, what do I actually own in what proportion, like, come and follow and check it out. On day 50, you're going to see that. I've got a bunch of learnings I want to share along the way. Like, I'm learning stuff as I do this. And I'll give you a couple examples of things I've learned. Like, in 2021, 22, I started building a China sub-portfolio. I bought a bunch of companies with the thought that maybe this was a hedge against like erosion of US dominance, you know, perhaps even, maybe a flippening of the US dollar being like the reserve currency of the world to China, to Asia somewhere. I got that wrong. And I probably didn't appreciate the extent to which like policy in Asia, particularly in China, was going to impact these stocks, and they're all through the floor, like horrifically so. So I'm kind of learning stuff by facing into the reality of the mistakes I've made there. And then that's going to help me improve in the future.
Let me ask you a question from a monkey to a badger. It's maybe one of the hardest things that people are faced with is looking themselves about their process objectively and then noticing a mistake. And then, and that's no small thing, by the way, because it's very tempting to see a mistake and quickly jump past as though it didn't happen, but actually noticing it and then actually changing something about your fundamental process. And in part, that's because it's painful. It's literally painful. Like whatever our brain chemistry does, right? You don't get dopamine, you get like skull and crossbones floating up like, oh, mistake made, bad, badger, bad. No, you know, like, and it just feels bad. to what extent what do you think you're doing or have been doing as an investor that allows you to complete this process from being motivated enough to do it, actually doing it, and then implementing changes?
It's a bit mushy, right? But I think the most important thing is just acknowledging good and bad decisions, and then trying to fathom out whether that was, like, you made a bad decision, but you got lucky, or you made a good decision and you got unlucky. You need to sort of get below that level of what actually happened to, was this fundamentally a good decision? That's what I'm trying to do. And then it just goes into the mush of, if I make a future investing decision, like, for example, probably my most recent investment in my main portfolio, and I'm going to be tweeting about it today, was Samsara, ticker IoT. I bought that just 2 months ago. And when I look at a company, like, I go and do some foundational fundamental research, and I look at lots of different factors like leadership and market positioning and all this sort of stuff. And I've also got in the back of my mind now the mistakes where I think I've made poor decisions in the past, because I'm conscious of it now, because I've done this, I'm now doing this kind of annual review, and that will influence me. So if I think about another learning from one of my investments, I talked about it last week on Twitter and TikTok and everywhere. I invested in Enphase Energy, the solar residential solar and storage company. And, like, I've lost a fair bit of money on that. And it's because I didn't think hard enough about the effect of higher interest rate environment. I consider that to be my most recent, like, objective mistake. I made a mistake in my process. And so, having reflected on that, that's now going to be up there. What's happening in macro? Like, what is the trajectory of interest rates and inflation? And how is that going to impact the investment I'm just about to make?
I wonder how much of that is hindsight bias. I'm not saying it is necessarily in this case, but it could be, because everything's obvious in the rearview mirror. Yep. One thing I'll note, though, Badger, is that from my perspective, most investors want quick and easy, and they just want to find a ticker, and they want to follow somebody else, and some work, some don't, and it's kind of casino-like. Right. What you are sharing with people is, you're modeling for people what it means to be reflective and self-reflective. So reflective about investments, because you do the research, you ask good questions, you go deep. But also you're reflecting on your own process, which is really what differentiates humans from all other animals. This is the way to invest, we would say, wisely for the long term with principle. This very process. So anyone listening here, apologies for the sermon, but this is not a small thing. It doesn't have to be Badger's process exactly per se, but you really do need to have a process that looks yourself in, allows you to look yourself in the mirror.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's one thing you can do. There's lots of things you can do. And actually, we share 10 of those. If you go check out wallstreetwildlife.com, and we recently posted a glossy PDF of our 10 laws of the jungle. And I don't know if we talked about sort of doing a review and being reflective. Maybe it's embedded in those laws, but we call out 10 specific things you can do and think about if you want to improve your investing processes.
I can't overstate the importance of what you're modeling for others. So if you have not followed Wall Street Wildlife on Instagram, please do that. And you're going to get one of Luke's company reviews once a day for the next 50 days.
Yeah, very good. And do check us both out on Twitter. You can find me at 7LukeHallard, and you can find Christoph at 7FlyingPlatypus.
All right. So what's the latest tool in the hacker's arsenal, and why does this make cybersecurity the most durable investing trend of this decade?
It really, you said that unconvincingly. I don't know if you believe that.
I said no, I believe it. I'm just pissed at myself that I sold CrowdStrike.
Oh, shit, yeah, that's right. You sold CrowdStrike. Oh, my God. fascinating anecdote from CrowdStrike CEO George Kurtz on, I think it was a Morgan Stanley technology conference, come up a level. Like, what's happened around cybersecurity in the last month or two that's really actually very interesting and important for investors and for every company is SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission regulations, tightened up. And now if you're a public company, you have to disclose to the SEC, well, to investors, you have to file an 8K if you have had a material breach. So you've been attacked in some way by some threat actor, like a bad guy. Mm. And you have to do that within 4 days of figuring out that you have this issue. So to start with, like, if cybersecurity wasn't the number one, like, a topic you talk about at every board meeting, and you have someone in the room at the board who's informed about this stuff, understands this stuff, and can reassure the board that your company's on top of it, well, you're asking for trouble, right? Every public company should be doing this now, and I'm sure they are. And if you're even a private company, you're probably a supplier to, like, one of your customers is probably a public company. So if they have a problem, they're going to be asking you hard questions as well, because your, you know, your failure could impact their own operations, and therefore they have to disclose that. So every company in the world has got to be thinking about this stuff really hard. So this fascinating anecdote from George Kurtz was a threat actor managed to hack a public company, and I think it was a ransomware attack. And then they tried to demand money to unransom the data, release the data that they'd sequestered. The company refused because they didn't, you know, you don't want to pay the bad guys. You're just funding terrorism, effectively. And so what the threat actor did was they reported the company to the Securities and Exchange Commission because the company had known about this and been debating it with the bad guy for a few weeks, and they hadn't disclosed within 4 days. Mm-hmm. So they get, suddenly the company's on the hook for breaking the regulations. That's incredible, right? So these guys, the bad guys, are not just attacking these companies. They're now essentially weaponizing this new legislation.
Yeah, it's not even like good guys, bad guys. It feels like anarchism in a sense. Like, I mean, like this kind of like malevolent, it's not even, right? It's a force. See, this is what I was talking about AI. Like, there's this new force, right, that's just playing. I mean, it's just staggering. But yes, the upshot, right, is that you can't be a business without cybersecurity. So it makes all the sense in the world to own a company like CrowdStrike.
And CrowdStrike is an expensive company. There's a bunch of other companies. Like, I tweeted the other day about Palo Alto Networks. Maybe I didn't get to that tweet yet, but it's coming up. Palo Alto Networks, like, it's the world's biggest pure play cybersecurity company. I own that one too. I know you used to own Sentinel One. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of other companies in this space. Like, it's a massive space with literally thousands of suppliers. But I think this is a space where the winners will keep winning. So mm-hmm. companies like CrowdStrike, Palo Alto, maybe Fortinet, companies like that are just going to benefit from this massive tailwind of ever-increasing regulations and ever more sophisticated and faster threats to business operations.
Yeah, and in the age of AI, the rate at which the attacks will come and the kind, I mean, it's people now know there's no, this isn't the 20s anymore or the 10s where, you know, you could be good enough for a while, and you need the state of the art, yeah, unquestionably. So that's why I'll be looking to buy back into a company like CrowdStrike and Zscaler as two examples, because they built their own businesses on the back of the latest technological AI software.
Yeah. CrowdStrike has Charlotte AI, which is essentially, it's to try and level up your, if you have like your cybersecurity team in your company, Charlotte AI is like a generative AI model to help you understand your own infrastructure and help you deploy CrowdStrike's capabilities. I mean, tiny sidebar, but it is fascinating. Like, tools like ChatGPT, well, LLMs are making hackers' lives easier and faster. And just an example, like, you've got the big, you know, publicly accessible LLMs like Perplexity and Claude and ChatGPT and Gemini, but you you have versions of these models that are specifically trained and designed to help the hacking community, to help threat actors do their job more effectively. And so what does that mean? It means you could now send like highly targeted, maybe phishing emails to executives within companies. Mm-hmm. And you could do that at massive, massive scale. And because you've got like an LLM helping you drive that, these could be like highly targeted emails. It's not like some, you know, Nigerian letter scam. This is like a very sophisticated way of having like a back and forth conversation with thousands of executives at the same time. And if one of them falls for it, well, potentially you've got an entry point to a company, and then that's where your ransomware attack starts.
Speaking of suspicious emails, I got one the other day from Prince Badger, asking me for some Bitcoin. He's like, "Dearest monkey." Oh man, I want to ask you whether you made any decisions, active decisions in the portfolio review.
I've reinforced a bunch of learnings, and I think facing into, like, I gave that example of China and of Enphase, and there's a bunch of other learnings coming up. I've spreadsheeted out my 50 days, but I haven't written those tweets, and I'm going to be thinking about each trade each day. So I'm working about 4 or 5 days ahead of myself, and I know there's a bunch of stuff I've done which I'll probably come to regret in the future. So let's see if I can learn from those. NVIDIA will be an interesting one because I got in fairly early with that, way ahead of the AI hype train, saw it coming. And then I've been managing my exposure by trimming, but I've kind of given up a ton of gains in doing that.
So a different way of asking this is, there is some company in your portfolio that's number 50, right? It's in last place. NuScale, correct?
Correct, yep.
You reviewed it. Are you keeping it?
Yeah, I am.
You adding to it?
No.
So you're keeping it, but you're not adding to it. 50 companies is a relatively large portfolio, but here you have this one company that's decidedly your lowest. And I tend to think in binaries. You either add or you sell, but you're just letting it be. What did you learn about looking at that particular company?
I'm continuing to hold it. So that is an active decision to hold. Like, it's eroded down. I bought it as a 1% position, and it's eroded down to a 0.1% position. I think this company's overwhelmingly likely to fail. But there's maybe a 5% chance that actually they can secure a new commercial customer and they can get to commercial scale. And if they do, it is an easy 100 bagger from today's valuation, maybe more. So I figure I'm taking a 5% shot at maybe 100 times on my money. So that adds up.
So you're thinking in the risk reward way.
Yeah.
And so
I would love to have more bets like that. I'd love to have like 10 or 20 bets like that. I've probably only got 2 or 3 bets like that.
So by that rationale, I should take your insight seriously, and I should buy 0.1% of this company today, or a teeny tiny, right? If I wanted to,
I would say you shouldn't look at anything another investor does and just go, like, copy what they do. I feel like I've done my foundational research on this company. I understand enough about this industry. It's so immaterial to my overall portfolio today that I'm no longer going to track it. So I'm just not watching it. But if I look at my portfolio at some point in the future and this thing is like back to a 1% position, because it's getting there, it's actually up 23% today, then I'll start to pay attention again.
Let me rephrase the question. Forget me. Hmm. If you did not own it today, right, by that rationale, you would go out into the open market and you would buy it.
I think that's implicit in what I'm saying. Yeah, that's a reasonable way to state it. Yeah.
And you would buy this teeny tiny amount?
I'd probably buy a little bit more, but like, I do have transaction costs when I invest. So there is that, right?
Okay.
It's
not the problem of inertia because you've already owned it. It's better to just leave it. You would, knowing what you know, given the research you've done, the self-reflection, you are confident enough about the risk-reward ratio here, that if you did not own it, you would actively go out and buy it.
Yes, I would. Yes. Probably a 0.5% position. And I'd like to look for other ones of those. The transaction costs are such that it's probably just not worth my while to do like a 0.4% to bring it back up to 0.5%.
So why not say go to 1%, just too risky?
Yeah, I think they're much riskier than when I first bought them. Yeah, they're far less likely to succeed. I may have given them like a 10% chance of succeeding. It's now sub 5%, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, that's really insightful.
Okay. Right. Cool. And I don't own 50 things, but I am going to reflect on some stuff that I was a previous owner of at some point in the 50-day journey. Like, for example, Netflix, which I got into, I think, just as they were pivoting to from like DVDs by mail to online. And I think I saw quite early that that was going to be like a winning business model. And that was probably one of the, well, certainly the best investing decision I ever made in my life and am ever likely to make was my first purchase of Netflix. Because that first purchase is a 250 bagger, I think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't get many of those in an investing lifetime.
Right. Although with the AI world that we're entering, who's to say? The world's about to change radically.
It is. It's changing radically. Maybe there are other 250 baggers in my portfolio today that are yet to reveal themselves.
All right.
Good discussion as ever, Christoph. Hopefully we answered those three big questions. We'll try and do this in future episodes. We'll try and orient our discussions around a big question for investors. You can find us on YouTube and all major podcast platforms. Subscribe now for a finance podcast that's as fun and playful, hopefully, as it is insightful.
And you can also find us at wallstreetwildlife.com, and that's where you can get that shiny PDF that Badger and Monkey put together called The Laws of the Jungle, which condense a lot of our long-term wisdom about investing. It's free, so check it out.
Christoph and I are also both lead advisors at 7investing.com. Go check it out. If you're interested in subscribing, if you use coupon code WILDLIFE, you can get a handsome discount. But maybe even better than that, just pay $1 for a one-week trial and check out nearly 200 different stock recommendations and a ton of foundational research on some of the world's greatest companies today.
Are you ready to become a beast of an investor? Your journey starts here.
A reminder that the people on this program may hold positions in the companies that are mentioned. Buying and selling stock carries financial risk, which could include loss of capital. The views in this program should not be taken as personalized advice. Before acting on any of the information provided, listeners are encouraged to consult a financial or tax professional.